You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Welcome to Merin Talks Money, the podcast in which people who know the markets explain the markets. I'm Merin Somerset Webb. Now, this week we are focusing on the one thing I know you all care about most, housing and mortgages. And for that topic, because it's so important, we are bringing in one of Bloomberg's best on the subject, Neil Callanan, who has written about the real estate and the mortgage market for more than 20 years. That's several cycles worth, Neil.
Definitely.
Now, and also you have a special treat this week, something slightly different. Instead of keeping the wonderful John Stepek just to 5 minutes at the top of the episode, we are yielding to pressure from all of you and letting him stick around for the whole thing. You can let me know later whether you think that is a good thing or not. Thanks, John.
I see that email my mum sent in. What then? That's good. I like that.
Yeah, do you know what? Ask her to stop sending it. 20 times is enough.
That's it, Mom. That's it.
Right. Now, we are going to start with some stories of misery because they may be coming. More may be coming. And Neil, tell us, explain to us just how bad things can get when house prices start falling.
So I'm Irish, obviously from the accent. And in Ireland, we had the perfect combination of a falling economy and rising interest rates in the last crash, which really compounded the property downturn. So in my own case, my flat had been worth about 375. It was a two-bed in a not-great suburb of Dublin. And I actually felt that was way too much. And I looked into renting, but to rent a similar property in the city centre would cost twice as much. And I figured they'll never fall 50%. I think they're going to fall a bit, but they'll never fall 50%. And 2 years after that, it's worth 72,000. And really, only about 2 years ago did it get back to what it had been worth when I bought it, not what it was worth. It's still worth probably 175 grand less than the peak. And that's how bad property prices can get when you go into a downturn at the same time as when interest rates are hiking, because the interest rate hikes mean fewer people are out there to actually buy it, and that can accelerate the declines, okay, obviously.
So you eventually got out evens in nominal terms, but you'll have lost quite a lot of money in real terms.
Absolutely. It was quite frustrating having to send money home every month for an apartment that I could barely live in, obviously, because I was living here. So that was difficult.
So the key phrase of yours that I think we should all keep in our minds is, it'll never fall 50%.
I mean, I don't see property prices in the UK falling 50%, but I do think they will fall a lot. And I think they will fall more than people expect. You see this constant effort from people in the industry, the vested interests, to kind of portray every single bit of kind of okay news as sign the bottom is in, the bottom is in. And of course, it's quite the opposite. We're actually just at the beginning of what's going to be a very interesting journey to see what actually happens. And the idea that 9 months in that property prices have bottom out because Rightmove asking prices rose is, on one level hilarious, because if I did own a flat in London, and let's say it was worth 500 grand, and I don't own a property here, but if I did, I could ask for £1 million for it. I'm not going to get it, but my asking price bears no resemblance in many cases to the price that the property is worth, particularly because estate agents have been promising people higher and higher prices in order to get the instruction, because there were so few properties on the market. So the prices that many are being offered at are completely unrealistic. And, I live in central London, and there was a purpose-built flat complex near me, and one of the apartments there sold for $375 recently. I was looking because actually I wouldn't mind living there. The next one that came on, almost identical, almost the same size, very little difference. Asking price $475.
Oh, don't buy that one.
I mean, you know, but now what we're going to have to do is you have this big long pause until that seller actually realizes my flat is completely overvalued, and if I actually want to sell it, I'm going to have to cut. But you're never going to see somebody really cut $100,000 in the first one. They're going to cut 20 and then 20 more and then maybe five and then maybe put it back up a bit just to make it look like you've cut it even less the next time. And, you know, all these tactics go on. But this is the problem with the market in the next while, is you're going to just see a standoff between buyers and sellers, and transactions are going to plummet, and it's going to be hard to get market evidence. But eventually, in a few months, sellers will start to capitulate. And you're starting to see some evidence of that, I think, at the million plus bracket. Not at the very high end, but in the million plus bracket, I think there is some capitulation happening. And you're also seeing some capitulation in all those areas that the London people moved out to during the pandemic, and the sudden realization of, actually, if I need to sell my house or flat to go back to London, the only person who can buy it is a local person, and they can't afford to pay anything near what I paid. And, you know, it's interesting to see that. The fastest pace of decline is in the southwest of England now, which is Cornwall and Somerset and Devon. And obviously everybody's headed off there in the pandemic, and now they're going to probably have quite a bad crash, I would say.
Well, this is interesting. I mean, John and I were quite a lot to unpick in everything you said there. But one of the things that John and I have been saying for a while now is that if you want to see the house price that's going to fall the fastest, go look for a big cold house in the country. They went up the most during the pandemic, and they're definitely going to come down the most now, you know, because one winter living in Northumberland, the countryside, and if you're not from the countryside in Northumberland, you're coming back to London pretty quickly, and at a hell of a loss. Now, taking on what you said, one of the things that always happens, and God, we're all old, the three of us, aren't we? We've all seen quite a few property cycles. One of the things that always happens is this standoff between buyers and sellers, this sort of transaction paralysis. Well, the buyers go, well, I'm not paying that. And the sellers go, well, I'm not selling for that. So we're in that period right now. But if you look at the RICS numbers, which I want to talk about, the latest numbers out on the housing market, you can see that a much higher number of sales are going through at below asking price than is normal. Normal being a market that's vaguely healthy, which is not this market. So right, 60 to 70%, I can't remember the numbers, 68% on the latest numbers out today, going for below asking price. And a more normal number in a normal market is about 30. So that tells us there's the beginnings of this happening. But John, what else is in this rather miserable report from RICS?
Well, it's just that thing where, so the RICS survey is basically a state agent saying what they think is going to happen to the market.
The key thing here is that they're telling the truth,
yes,
in the RICS.
Yes.
So mostly when you hear estate agents talking, they're lying. Now, we know that. They're telling you what they think you can get for your house so that you'll bring your instruction to them. And we know it's not true. And they're telling you there were 10 viewers when in fact there were none, etc. So we know what's normally going on with estate agents. But on RICS, when it comes to the survey, they're telling the truth, telling anonymously what they really think, right?
Yeah, and it's surprisingly accurate. In terms of, if you take, like, I usually print a chart in my newsletter whenever the RICS figures come out. And it's basically, if you take their forecasts for the next 3 months and you advance them 3 months and you compare it to what's happening with house prices, it's actually really surprisingly accurate. The only time they've been notably wrong was during 2020, but that's because they were proved wrong because the Bank of England made a massive intervention in effect in the housing market and in interest rates, and so that kind of stopped the whole market from collapsing during COVID. But yeah, so I suppose the other interesting thing about it is that we have sort of been hearing, like, the Halifax house prices figure was, oh yeah, prices were flat in January, and as Neil was saying, right move, tried to start the year with a bit of good cheer. And the house builders have been saying that, well, they're seeing a bit of interest, a bit more than it was at the bottom. But the RICS survey today really just had none of that. The estate agents were even gloomier than they were in December. Sales are static. There's fewer buyer inquiries.
I thought that was the most interesting chart of all. If you look at there's a chart of buyer inquiries over the last couple of years, and you can see that, you know, first half of 2020, the line goes absolutely berserk, going up as everyone desperately wants to move, sadly, to these houses in the southwest. And now you look at it and you can see it is plummeting like a stone.
Yeah, I mean, and that makes sense. I mean, so we had a massive mortgage shock in October and November. And there are some people who at that point would have been kicked off their transaction. And they probably are still committed to buying, because once you get that far in the process, you're like, I really don't want to stick with where I am. But that backlog's probably already clearing now that mortgage rates have come down a little bit and mortgages are now available again. And so you're probably quite rapidly going into that phase where all the people who still wanted to move have moved. All the people who can wait are now sitting there going, well, I don't really want to move now if prices might fall by X percent shortly. I've also had that horrible mortgage shock, but now rates are coming down, so I can afford to kind of wait. So I think that, I mean, it's that thing of you're starting to see that stalemate. And I think the thing is, the buyers always think that time's on their side, but it's not, because, I mean, if the Bank of England cuts interest rates, it will be because the wider economy is deteriorating. And that means that actually, much as I hate to say it, your job might be at risk. Whereas if, fingers crossed, we don't get a big recession, then there's no reason for the Bank of England to cut interest rates. And that means that this is probably as good as it gets, or as close to as good as it gets for mortgage rates.
You know, you're not actually crossing your fingers.
Oh, well, yeah.
Which is kind of bad.
I'm not superstitious. No,
right. Neil is waving, trying to interrupt. Neil, sorry, you don't Neil. Understand how these podcasts work. You just talk over John when you want to talk. No, that's how I do it.
Politeness, oh dear. I just think the January numbers all need to be treated with a degree of scepticism. As John said, we had the mortgage shock in September, but also, separate to that, people don't buy houses in January, in December. So you get a natural pickup in January anyway. So, you know, it's again, people are reaching for that soft landing thing as quickly as they possibly can to kind of provide evidence that actually it's okay and kind of calm nerves, because while people talk about real estate like it's an asset a lot of the time, no, it's actually the most emotional decision in a way you can make outside of family. And emotion plays a big part of it, as does psychology. And so if you're worried that prices are going to go down, you're not necessarily going to be rushing out to buy a house because you're like, oh my God, it could go wrong and blah, blah, blah. And that needs to, again, work through the system. And some people have found comfort in interest rates where they are, but for a lot of people, that's just too high and they're not going to be able to afford prices as they're currently being quoted at least, rather than necessarily selling out.
Yeah. I would say one of the things that I always think of as a massive warning sign is incentives from the house builders. When they really can't sell and they don't want to cut the price of a house because, you know, that looks bad, right? So you certainly don't want to do that. So what you do is you try and cover up falling prices and falling demand by offering people freebies. And we see this in every single cycle. And you get the free kitchen fittings, you get the free bathroom. You're like, they weren't getting a bathroom in the first place and then you build, but whatever. So you get the free bathroom stuff with the bathroom upgrade. And then you get the carpets. And I think once you get free carpets, you know, all the danger bells are ringing, right? And we always say to people, if someone offers you a free carpet, you're paying too much for the house. So you must definitely offer less for the house. Don't take the carpets, offer less for the house, because that's the way it should be. And then gradually over the cycle, the incentives get bigger and bigger and bigger. We'll pay your mortgage, we'll pay your stamp duty, we'll pay this, we'll pay that. And then just around the bottom, and this is the thing we tell people to look after, comes the car. There comes a point when one house building company will start offering you a free car to buy their house. And I always think that's a little bit of a buy signal. I don't know. What do you think?
I think if anybody ever offers me incentives, I'll say, no, I'll take the discount, please. Particularly with mortgage rates the way they are now. The idea, in fact, that you're paying for a carpet at 4 or 5% seems a bit crazy.
Taking out a mortgage on a carpet.
I'd rather take the money. Thank you very much. But yeah, cars are a good sign that we're near the bottom.
I'm not suggesting you should take the car. I'm suggesting that it means you can get 30 grand off the price of the house.
Absolutely, yeah.
But the other problem in the new builds, though, is that those are the first ones on which mortgage lending dries up, because obviously it tends to be, if you're buying a new build, it's normally the first-time buyer end that tends to go for that. And also, new builds are already overpriced, so because they lose value the same way as a new car does. It's never a good time for house builders, because you know they've just finished building all these things at maximum cost, and then they're trying to flog them at a time when the banks are most wary of lending on those specific types of houses as well.
Mm. It's interesting, isn't it? I've always wondered why. Maybe you can answer this, Neil. Why do you not have to pay a higher deposit on a new build than you do on a second-hand house, given that the new build is definitely going to lose value in the short term?
Banks tend to look at these things dispassionately, and it's based on your ability to repay the mortgage rather than necessarily the property, as long as they're happy with the valuation.
But you walk into negative equity on day one.
You absolutely do, and I think the one of the most interesting things that is that we need to watch for the next 2 years is the Help to Buy, and you know that has completely skewed the new home market. It's sent the premiums on new homes rocketing, so there should be room for builders to actually cut prices quite a lot. Now, unless they overpay for the land, which is quite likely. But also those people who bought on Help to Buy are probably in negative equity if they bought recently. But then when it comes to refinance at the end, have to pay more in because the government guarantee is disappearing. So you're going to have all these people facing much higher repayments in terms of mortgage payments, but also on the value side in terms of the size of their mortgage, but also on a property where they've lost lots of money. And I think that's a trend that we're going to really have to watch for the next 2 years. A lot of people will have made bad decisions and are going to suffer badly from it.
That's interesting. We've written a lot about Help to Buy over the years, saying, you know, we don't think it's a particularly good idea for anybody except for the house builders. And, you know, the huge profits that the house builders have made out of, I find particularly, I'm going to stick with irritating for now. But do you think that there's any good that has come out of Help to Buy?
The one thing that it has helped a lot of people who otherwise would not have been able to afford to buy a house. So if you look at the English Housing Survey, the percentage of people needing money from family and friends in order to buy a place has shrunk dramatically in the last few years. And a large part of that is obviously lower interest rates as well, but I do think Help to Buy has made some difference there.
But it's helped them buy a house that is now going to destroy their finances.
Well, it can destroy their finances, but it'll only destroy their finances if they actually come to sell. If they can hold through a cycle, then they should probably be okay.
Yeah.
But on the issue of Help to Buy, I've been running an ongoing graphic for probably 5-6 years now called Help to Boom, which kind of shows how every single time the housing market starts to turn negative, the government comes in and intervenes and does something to help buyers and support the market. And that's going to be another thing to really watch, whether the government is willing to annoy a lot of its natural voters who have gotten used to their house price going up by £40,000 a year and doing some sort of scheme to help bolster
the market.
But
what is there left? What is there left? They've done everything. And what we've seen in the last cycles that we've lived through, they've been very small cycles that all of us have seen, because the government has stepped in really quickly with lower interest rates. And one of the things that John and I are writing about is, you know, people go, oh, well, house prices always come back. It always looks like a blip in the great scheme of, et cetera. But most of those occasions have seen interest rates fall dramatically, and that sort of sorts things out. But that is definitely not going to happen this time. We can't have more Help to Buy. What can they do? Put in a sort of mortgage tax relief or something old-fashioned like that?
I can't see them doing that. I just don't, politically, it's unpalatable for them to do that now. But I would agree with you on that level, because like back home, just before the massive crash, you know, they cut stamp duty as the last kind of thing to keep the market going. And, you know, the government keeps on tinkering with stamp duty and cutting stamp duty to keep the market going. And it sends it up for a few months, and then reality sets in. You know, these measures do not help people buy houses, they help people who own houses, and so they become more unaffordable. And then you have another announcement designed apparently to help home buyers, but actually they are, in effect, they help the people who already own homes by sending the values of their properties higher. I have skepticism that they can do it this time.
But it's not that. I actually think the political calculus has changed quite a lot. I mean, the average age of the first-time buyer is like something stupid, like in mid-30s now. The amount of money they have is massive. There are now, what, only, I'm trying to remember the last census, but something like 30% odds of people own their homes outright with no mortgage at all. About 30% have a mortgage, and most of those are people who are already better off than the average. So you have this massive sort of like voter pool of people who are incredibly pissed off that they can't buy a house. And you know, we talk about the kind of, you know, the Conservatives as being the natural party of homeowners, but all of this happened largely under New Labour in the kind of Tony Blair, Gordon Brown government. And at that point, this is not a political point. My point is more at one point it was a massive vote winner to keep house prices going up as much as possible. I don't actually think that's the case anymore. I think even people who own houses, like people who are older than us, I think a significant proportion of them are thinking, oh God, how are my kids going to afford the house? And so okay, they've got loads of assets, but they're realising, well, I'm going to have to refunnel half of this, you know, my pension and all the rest is going to spend go on buying my kids a house. So that's not ideal either. So
I think also that people with no mortgage, people who own their houses outright, don't really care whether house prices go up or down.
No, I
it
don't
doesn't
think
make any difference
do.
To them. Aye, you know, most yeah. people, if they understand if yeah. they haven't got financing Aye. On it, then the price of the house is by yeah. the by. And if house prices fall, then that doesn't make any difference to their net position. In fact, it improves their net position if they're going one particular way. So it's entirely by the by. So that 30% doesn't make any difference
yeah,
to them,
aye.
Except for, as you say, in the context of their children.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, and again, I think it's worth remembering this is a global thing. It's happening everywhere. And I mean, which is basically down to the fact that, again, this is all a function of falling interest rates. And that is what it fundamentally boils back down to. Interest rates spiked in October. They are improving now. But wherever they're going to settle, it's going to be about twice as much as they were a year ago, 18 months ago. And unless something insane happens, which would almost certainly involve unemployment trebling from where we are now, then interest rates are not going back to 0%. Because that was a one-off. That was a 5,000-year low. And I just don't see how we get back to there again.
Mm. Where do you think mortgage rates will settle, Neil?
I think they'll settle above 4%, possibly towards 5%. And anything above 4% tends to lead to price falls. So,
And that one, so we've got an awful lot of people who are on fixes, because remember, a lot of the UK people with mortgages are on fixes 2 or 5 years, but the majority on 2 years, right? So there'll be a lot of people rolling off soon who are going to have a very unpleasant shock.
Yeah, it's going to get really tough for people this year. And I mean, this is one of the things that might drive the price transparency is the number of people who suddenly realize they can't afford to own their home anymore and may have to sell and trade down, which is something we haven't really seen in 15, 20 years.
Yeah, we saw no forced selling in 2008 exactly. and no forced selling in 2020.
So,
right?
So I don't think the bank is going to like intervene and tell them, but I think a lot of people will just make the decision and kind of go, look, this, I can't do this. Particularly when there's so much general inflation as well, you know, and so many people are being squeezed in so many ways, they just may not have the money to be able to afford a house.
And we'd expect a reasonable amount of forbearance from the banks, presumably.
I think that will always happen now. I think politically, the banks aren't willing to do that. They will find ways to extend mortgage terms or find ways to give mortgage holidays and so forth. And that's going to be a trend to watch as well.
Right, so one thing that we haven't covered yet is how to actually get the best mortgage deal. So, Neil, any top tips for people out there who are looking to remortgage just now?
I think the main piece of advice is get ready as early as you can, because mortgage rates are so variable at the moment in all of that terms meanings that the rate you get today may not be the rate you get in a couple of months, and you can always go back and change it. So get your documents prepped ready and get them prepped early, and then you can start to look around. Usually through a broker is the handiest way people turn to, but start to look around for the rate that suits you. I think one thing people don't think enough about is whether injecting a little bit more equity can get them to an LTV where they get a much lower rate. And so you do take a little bit of a short-term pain in terms of that money going out of your account if you have money in your account these days. Not all of us do. And then using that to lower the rate you pay on an ongoing basis. And I know many people have like saved an awful lot of money just from going from a 90% LTV to a 75% LTV, or going from a 75% LTV down to a 60% LTV. So, you know, that's something people really need to consider.
So that's just boosting effectively your deposit or the amount of equity you've got in the house. And I think the other thing is, because we're recording this at the moment, so obviously it's February, and about 5 months ago, mortgage rates spiked really badly, and they have come down a lot since then. So I think the other thing for people to remember is that if you're looking around, currently the Best Buy tables are kicking around. You can get like under 4% for a 5-year fix, for example, I noticed. So just whenever you go into that conversation, just be aware of what is out there and what is possible. But yeah, I think that's about it, really, and good luck.
The last time we saw big waves of forced selling was back in the early 90s, wasn't it? That was the last time when things got really, really unpleasant, people totally underwater and having to sell at negative equity and make up the difference, etc.
And that was one of the reasons why that downturn got so aggressive, is the banks foreclosed and forced properties onto the market, which then drove prices further down. And I think they're wary of that as well. They're going to try and, I don't think they necessarily mind a short, sharp fall, but I don't think they want a proper crash.
Well, they don't want the reputational difficulties of turfing people out.
Okay. I think it's also worth reminding people, you know, a 20% crash gets us back to where we were in 2020. It's not the end of the world. It's hard for those people who got affected by that. But if we go, you know, if you remember in 2020, a lot of us were saying prices were overvalued then.
Well, they were.
So it's like when you... how far do you go before it's a real crash? And they did look massively overvalued. I saw a report last week saying on metrics that London and the South East is probably 40% overvalued. We're not saying they're going to fall 40%, but that's what the metrics
show. Why would they not fall 40%? If they're 40% overvalued, why would they not fall 40%? Sure, a bit of forbearance, but that aside, prices normally revert to a mean. They go back to the correct valuation. So everyone says this, they're horribly overvalued, but they won't fall that much. Why?
I think outside London, it's possible in certain regions. I think in London, the foreign money starts to come in, particularly with the weak pound, and that's what makes the difference. So that helps the market find a floor, and it will be Asian money coming in to buy properties that look very cheap in their local currency. It's exactly what happened last time as well, where once you had a 20% decline in London prices in local currency, for them it was a 50% decline. So it made sense to start buying, and they have obviously been some of the more aggressive buyers in the last market. Another thing that might help bail out the market is a lot of private equity funds have been bailing out home builders actually for the last few years, because the home builders couldn't sell the properties they had built, and private equity firms and institutional landlords came in and bought up entire blocks at bulk discounts of 10 to 20%. And so there comes a point where actually it makes sense for them on a monetary basis to step in and start buying things. So there's floors in London that don't necessarily exist elsewhere.
Okay, so London is weirdly safer than elsewhere. But if you had to make a bet on how far house prices would fall across the country, where would you go? Would you be a minus 10 person, a minus 20, a minus 30? Clearly not a minus 40.
I'd be towards minus 30.
I've said minus
20% by next year, but I think this one will last long.
Okay.
Longer.
So minus 30 plus a little inflation. So you actually are on minus 40 in real terms at least.
Yeah, potentially. From the peak, yeah.
This is a scarred man. So. Scarred man.
I thought I was bearish.
John's on minus. You're on minus 30, aren't you?
I'm on minus 30, but that's only real.
You're on minus 20 real. Nominal, minus 30 real.
The logic for it is this, and I think it's important to think about this. Inflation last year was about 10%. Inflation this year is expected to be 7%. And then next year, depending on who you listen to, it might be 2 to 4%. So you're over 20% probably in inflation terms at that stage. And house prices have, on top of that, already fallen 4%. And we're just at the beginning. So, you know, while my gut is tense saying this, I do think that 40% in real terms, I got to stress in real terms, is a possibility.
Okay. Well, I think we can probably finish on that extremely positive note. The house prices in the UK are only going to fall by something in the region of 30 to 50% in real terms. That's absolutely marvellous. Thank you both, Neil, John, for your optimistic and positive contributions to this podcast on the nation's favourite subject. Right. Thanks for listening, everybody. Thank you for listening to this week's Merin Talks Money. We will be back next week. In the meantime, if you like our show, and that does not mean if this show made you depressed or not depressed, that's not it. If you like the information, rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to the podcast positively, please. Thank you to everyone who has done that already. We have some great reviews. And John, of course, goes through those when he needs a little pick me up from worrying about the property market. Thanks, John. This episode was hosted by me, Merin Zumzet-Webb. It was produced by Summer Sadi. Additional editing by Blake Maples. And special thanks, of course, to Neil Callanan and to John Stepek. Finally, let me remind you once more to sign up to John's daily newsletter, Money Distilled, which is excellent and occasionally drifts away from talking about property, doesn't it, John?
Only very occasionally.
Very occasionally.
I mentioned AI the other day.
Excellent. And you'll get quite a lot on investing and personal finance in general as well. The link is in the show notes. You will not regret signing up. Thank you.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.